Welcome to the podcast of the Consortium for History of Science, Technology, and Medicine. I'm Babak Ashrafi. Today is December 19th, 2023, and I'm speaking with Donald Opitz. Don is associate professor at DePaul University, and this year he is the Keith S. Thompson Research Fellow at the Consortium. Thank you for joining us, Don.
It's my pleasure, Babak.
Don, can you tell us a little bit about your work, your background, and how you came to your research project for this fellowship?
Yeah, I'm happy to. So I'm an historian of science by training, and I'm very interested in sort of the cultural situation of science. And I've always gravitated in my research to looking at how science and culture intermingled in the 19th century, and especially within the British imperial context. Within that work, I had paid particular attention to the role of women in science or women's support of science from the sidelines, so both as practitioners and as supporters. And the 19th century is a very interesting period, both for the development of the sciences, but also for the advancement of women in terms of education and their participation in the professions. So, you know, we often talk about the first wave of feminism and usually date that towards the end of the 19th century as advocates push for women's education, higher education, secondary education, and then also just in a lot of ways, pushing for women's equality with respect to men. Within the sciences, it's known that women have often been pushed to the sidelines. They often have been excluded from professional science spaces and laboratories. But in alignment with the opening of education and professions to women, and especially in the British context, which is what I study, the scientific disciplines were opened up to women in a variety of interesting ways. I've always been interested also in how women, despite their exclusion in more formal spaces of the sciences, also participated in the informal spaces of the sciences and what we often think of as those contexts in which amateurs had contributed to the sciences. You know, and I'm thinking here of things like bug hunting and stargazing, that sort of thing. So as I had delved into, a major research project that looked at the role of the British aristocracy in advancing the sciences towards the end of the 19th century, I had come across training programs for women in horticulture and agriculture. And these training programs were set up to be based in technical and scientific education. It involved a combination of formal, like book learning and lecturing, as we think of, typical classroom education, but partnered with practical education. So working in the fields and getting hands-on experience. And some of that was also experimental. So how is it that you create new varieties of crops, hybrids, and that sort of thing? And so there were experimental gardens that were coupled with sort of the classroom education in programs specifically set up for women. And again, within a context in which women were seeking to obtain higher education in the sciences and in general. It was interesting for me to learn that the aristocrats I was studying were also promoting and funding the creation of these new schools. And so I had at some point focused on the establishment of these schools. One was called the Horticultural College at Swanley, or just Swanley for short. And another one was called the Studley College. And these were both set up by aristocratic founders and became dedicated programs that were single sex for women only. So there's a lot of rich detail there for those schools. As I delved into the history of these schools, how they were set up, the curriculum, the faculty, the students, the outcomes, what it is that they learned and what did alumni go on to do. I became aware that these schools partook in a broader movement of education for women in horticulture and agriculture internationally. And that was promoted through associations and organizations set up for this general field, but focusing on women. So there were national associations, such as the National Women's Farm and Garden Association in the United States. There was a similar one in the UK. There was an international union in agriculture and horticulture for women. And all of that, you know, occurred in a context in which women's unions and international congresses were happening, again, in that early first wave of feminism, part of this broader movement for the education of women. So that's a long story to say that I became very interested in this particular area of education and practice for women in fields that historically have not really gotten the same level of attention by historians as, you know, biology and chemistry, you know, the traditional scientific fields. And, you know, partly because these are more applied fields, but they did matter. And they did matter for, you know, the more traditional scientific disciplines, you know, such as genetics. That's the background to this project. And now what I'm doing is I'm carrying this project forward and working on a book that looks at the international context for women's education in these fields and how this played out on an international stage.
Do you want to say a little bit about what's happening in agriculture and horticultural science per se?
So in addition to this movement that was happening to promote women's higher education and to promote women in the sciences, in parallel, there was a sort of professionalization and industrialization that was happening within the fields of agriculture and horticulture. Within the broader context of the Industrial Revolution, there was this rise of, again, germane to my subject, technical education, and a greater emphasis on technology and the use of technologies in the sciences. And there was a real concern about making agriculture more efficient, more profitable, you know, for yields to be increased. And this especially happened within markets where there was steep competition internationally, but then also environmental challenges. You know, how is it that we deal with, you know, different environmental and ecological conditions? So agriculture itself became an industrialized field. The use of more machinery, the use of more, what I would say, theoretical perspectives that drove the way, you know, fields would be planted and farmed and harvested and so on. So there was a movement to promote technical education in agriculture, and it focused on, you know, early on educating men in these fields. But because this was happening at the same time that women were seeking opportunities for higher education, there were developed programs that focused on women. So there's an interesting parallel happening, and there's a lot of rhetoric that talks about sort of the professionalization of the agricultural and horticultural sciences, the use of science itself as a term to distinguish these fields, you know, again, rhetorically. It wasn't just a matter of practice, of craft, of traditional knowledge, but the application of new scientific knowledge to make these fields more efficient and technical. My project doesn't exactly go into that, you know, broader scientification of these fields, but it's an important part of the background to why is it that, you know, societies were interested in educating women and educating them in a particular way that leveraged the sciences and technical know-how.
Is it too early to ask maybe what kind of questions you might ask about this history that would shed light and inform the way people who are concerned now about science education for women would find informative or useful?
Yeah, I think that's a great question, Babak. And so what is it that we learn, you know, by looking at women's participation in agriculture and horticulture? What is it that we learn about their scientific training? What does that say about the situation of women in the sciences more broadly, both historically and then also today? And why should we care about that? You know, and especially today in a context in which there's a lot of concern over equality and diversity in STEM fields, science, technology, engineering, mathematics, and medicine. And I would say that because historically this has been a area of research that has not received as much attention as other areas of research, you know, the more traditional sciences, we're missing a piece of the story, an important piece of the story that helps us understand the logics at play, you know, in terms of social discourses and assumptions about men's and women's abilities, you know, both intellectually, but also physically, that made certain genders more suitable for certain sciences, you know, as opposed to other genders. It's very interesting, the rhetorics that employed assumptions about sex and gender, and specifically, you know, who is appropriate for plowing fields and why that is. And I would say that the lessons that we learn by looking at women's status within agriculture and horticulture, you know, historically, helps us unpack and understand similar logics that are at play about women's participation in laboratory-based sciences. And there's some classic historical essays and books that talk about it wasn't just a matter of assumptions about, you know, women's and men's brains and how they're different, capacities for mental labor, and then also whether or not studies in the sciences took away from more appropriate activities for women. Oh, but also, you know, there were assumptions that had just to do with ideas about heroism. You know, and I'm thinking of a wonderful essay by Naomi Oreskes that talks about it wasn't that women are overly emotional and just not suitable for the rigors of logic in the sciences, you know, which is one of the assumptions that was made to exclude women, but also that they were not constitutionally suitable for the rigors of the heroic activities that one would bring to the field sciences and explorations and expeditions and that sort of thing. And it's that kind of, you know, false assumption, of course, you know, these are myths and rhetorics that are often used. It's that sort of discourse that comes up in the space of agriculture and horticulture that I find so fascinating and rich for understanding, you know, unspoken assumptions about men's and women's abilities. So, you know, women dressed in poofy skirts, you know, back in the Victorian period had no place in greenhouses. You know, not only, you know, was there probably concerns about their dresses getting dirty, but, you know, plants would get knocked over and things like that. So it did beg a lot of questions about, you know, suitability in cultural terms.
Can you talk a little about the consortium collections, how you might be using them and what you expect to find?
I'm very excited about this research fellowship because I held a fellowship previously and I dipped into a variety of collections and especially collections held in the Philadelphia area and in other places on the East Coast. They're very rich collections of papers, you know, manuscripts, letters, notebooks, account books that contain information about the planning that was taking place to set up these schools. And one example is the Pennsylvania School for Horticulture for Women that was based in Ambler, Pennsylvania. And the founder of that school, Jane Bowne Haynes, was a prominent educated, you know, Bryn Mawr College graduate of a prominent family. Her ancestors were the Wisters, and the Wisters were a well-known scientific family. You know, they had set up what became known as the Wister Institute. Jane's brother, Casper, was on the board of the Wister Institute. So Jane herself was very well educated. And I only scratched the surface of the Haynes family papers in my last research fellowship. There's also the WIC papers. So these are held at the American Philosophical Society. So I'm very excited to visit the APS again, not only because it's a beautiful setting, but because the collections there for my project are very rich. Also looking forward to the Pennsylvania Historical Society, which holds records that are pertinent to understanding the formation of garden clubs, which is another, you know, part of this project. So there were these, you know, formal educational programs based at colleges and universities. But in parallel, there were local efforts to create garden clubs. And the founders of these garden clubs were the very same people that were also founding the schools and the associations, you know, that provide the context for this movement. So the Pennsylvania Historical Society holds garden club records that I'm very excited to delve into. There's also records at the Huntington Library. I've learned that some of the graduates of the schools who became philanthropists that supported the sustainability of the schools left papers that are held at the Huntington Library. The same for libraries at the Smithsonian Institution and at the Schlesinger Library at Harvard. And the Schlesinger Library is of particular interest as well because they are the site where the papers of the National Women's Farm and Garden Association of the U.S. are held. And they have a full run of those records. And it's one of the key associations that I'm researching for this book.
Great. Anything else to say at this early stage?
I do want to say one more thing. And it's the sort of thing that drives, you know, me in this project. So in addition to just learning about, you know, historically women's roles in the sciences and how science became gendered and the position of agriculture and horticulture, you know, within those subjects, I also see that this book in progress and, you know, once it's finished, will contribute to our histories of not only women in science, but also women in agriculture and horticulture as fields of practice and what that meant for the history of those fields. And then within the context of national concerns over rural society, over developments in agriculture and horticulture, and how those national concerns played out, not just in the U.S., but also in other places like the U.K. So there's a broader historical context that I'm very interested in and that I believe my book will contribute to beyond just the history of science.
Terrific. Thank you, Don. Thank you for sharing your project with us at this early stage. I look forward to hearing more about it in due course.
And thank you, Babak, for hosting me to give a little preview of my project.
Happy to do it. You can find more resources for exploring this topic as well as others at www.chstm.org. This has been a podcast from the Consortium for History of Science, Technology, and Medicine.